Well, a new report out this week says 36 million people are living in modern-day slavery across the globe. The Australia-based group Walk Free released the second edition of its Global Slavery Index, which surveyed 167 countries and found that 60,000 slaves are living right here in the U.S., which, as we know, has its own painful history with slavery, a history that Edward Baptist says we don't often acknowledge as a major driver of the country's early economic growth. His new book is The Half Has Never Been Told, Slavery and the Making of American Capitalism. Edward Baptist is with us from Atlanta. Welcome.
It's great to be here, and thanks for having me.
And when you say the half has never been told, what you're talking about is an acknowledgement that without slavery, America's economy never would have grown into the global dominant economy that it is.
Yeah, I think that's one way to view the half. The other is to understand that a lot of that critique, that understanding of history was always there, in particular in the memories of formerly enslaved people.
So why do you think that that half has not been told?
Well, I think that by and large, the United States and more broadly Western societies have not wanted to hear that story over the last couple of centuries. We've lived through this period of increasing prosperity by and large, where we've had the fundamental transformation of our economies in a way that the world has never seen. And of course, there have been ups and downs, the Civil War, World War II, World War I. Communism, et cetera. But over the course of that time, our world has been transformed by this sort of economic growth. And we don't want to hear that at its root, the economic growth depends to a large extent on slavery.
Well, make your case for us. Explain how important slavery was for the growth of the early American economy.
Well, both for the American economy and for the British economy, it's important to understand that the massive transformations that they go through in the 19th century, they shift from being primarily agricultural to primarily industrial in terms of how they make their wealth, how they generate their income. These processes happen first and foremost in cotton textile factories. And in order to have cotton textile factories, which are the first factories of the industrial system, and they change the way that people wear clothes all around the world, the way they buy clothes, the way that trade happens, the way that people work as they're now working in these factories instead of in the fields. None of that is possible without having cheap cotton. And cheap cotton, above all, is delivered to those factories by enslaved people in the expanding American South. In fact, they can deliver cotton so cheaply and to such a massive extent that they essentially put all other cotton producers out of business by the 1830s.
And you write in the book, cotton became the dominant driver of U.S. economic growth in 1802. Cotton already accounted for 14% of the value of all U.S. exports, but by 1820, it accounted for 42%.
Yeah, and that just continues to grow. In fact, from 1820 to 1860, over that long period of time, over half of all the money that's earned by U.S. products overseas comes from one single product, and that's cotton. You know, cotton plays a role that's kind of analogous in the world economy of the 19th century to what you see petroleum and petroleum products playing in our world today.
And you look at some of the detail that you bring up in this book, and particularly you're talking about New Orleans as the pivot of economic expansion. And you describe a New Orleans that looks very different from the New Orleans we see today, with just ship after ship after ship lined up there in New Orleans, ready to take export of all of this cotton.
That's right. That's right. It's the leading cotton port in the world. And it's also, by some measures in the 1830s, the most important financial center in the United States. There's capital coming in. There's capital coming out. And eventually it'll lose that fight. And New York, of course, will become the financial center. But there's a moment where it looks like it can be. And there's one other thing that it's a crucial center for, and that's for the domestic slave trade. And that's the process of moving almost a million enslaved African Americans from the older states, where the chance for profits from field labor are not as good, but the chance for profits from selling people to the domestic slave traders are very good. So they get moved from those old states and are transported to the new states, where cotton planters in particular are ready to pay extremely high amounts of money in order to buy, typically 16 to 25-year-olds, men and women.
And we know from history that there were people in this country who thought that slavery was abhorrent and thought that it should go away. But it looks, from what you're writing, that all along the way, those who really had the power of the federal government decided to allow it to happen because they knew how important it was to the economy of the U.S.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think there's a sense among some American policymakers around the time of the Constitution that slavery is doomed as an institution. We have to bargain with slaveholders right now who, after all, controlled a lot of the wealth of the country. But over time, as we can see, their profitability is decreasing. The planters of tobacco and rice and so on in particular are in hard times in the 1780s. As we see their profitability is decreasing, we can let slavery, in effect, die out on its own, especially if we close the slave trade from Africa. But because there was such a large population of enslaved people already, and because a new source of profit, the growing of cotton and the shipping of cotton to the new factory system, because that came up, it turned out that that calculation was completely wrong, in fact.
We're talking with Edward Baptist, author of The Half Has Never Been Told, Slavery and the Making of American Capitalism, a provocative argument there. And you can weigh in at hereandnow.org. Would the U.S. economy be what it is now without slavery? This is Here and Now, and if you're just joining us, we've been speaking with Edward Baptist. He's the author of The Half Has Never Been Told, Slavery and the Making of American Capitalism. And Edward Baptist, we think of the people who were profiting from the slave trade as being in the South, at least the slave owners are having more direct tie to slavery. But in fact, you write, historians have been ignoring that investors from the North and from abroad benefited from slave labor cotton in the South. How did they benefit?
Yeah, I think this is something that historians are actually now starting to really catch hold of and run with. But it's a remarkable story. There, for instance, is a huge firm of slave traders, one of the biggest businesses in the United States by any measure in the years 1830 to 1832 or so. Isaac Franklin of Tennessee, John Armfield of Virginia, and Rice Ballard of Mississippi and Virginia. And these three individuals mastermind the moving of about 5,000 enslaved human beings a year from the older states to the new states. Now, this necessitates a huge amount of money and a huge amount of credit. And that means they have to have great relationships with banks. And they have great relationships with banks in Richmond and in Mississippi, and above all with the Bank of the United States, which is an officially chartered bank. The main depositor of the United States government at that time, also serves as sort of the Federal Reserve as a regulator of the economy. And, oh, yeah, they're constantly lending money and getting paid back by these slave traders.
Would the slave trade have been able to grow to the size that it did without that amount of credit coming from these banks?
Probably not. Probably not. That certainly makes the operations much more efficient. It makes slave buyers in places like Maryland or Virginia, it makes it much easier for them to pay a sort of uniform or standard predictable price. And then on the other hand, those close links to the banks in places like Mississippi enable them to help buyers line up loans from local banks and so on and so forth. Credit is crucial to the process.
And you use the word efficient there. The other thing that was crucial to the process, you write, is these slave owners being just absolutely awful to the slaves to try to get them to produce more stuff and more quickly.
Yeah. When you look at the history of the Industrial Revolution and the factory system, one of the things that's remarkable and one of the things that is at the bottom of how it makes a difference in our lives is the fact that the shift to organized, rationalized, machine-based production over time means that for a given amount of labor, 8-hour day, a 12-hour work day by a worker, the product that comes out is greater. And this is absolutely crucial, continues to this day. But at the same time, we don't think that that kind of productivity increase is possible in hand labor, or we sometimes don't think that. But it turns out that, in fact, in the production of cotton in the fields of the southern United States, enslaved people year after year produce cotton more and more efficiently. The average enslaved person picks 2% per day faster every single year from 1800 to 1860. And that means that by 1860, the average cotton picker is four times as efficient as they were in 1800. And this helps to explain how these different link processes of increasing productivity, increasing efficiency, work together to create this much bigger dramatic economic change.
One of the ways that you did the research for this book was to listen to interviews that had been done with former slaves. And we have a little bit of tape from one of them. Let's take a listen.
If I thought that I'd ever be a slave again, I'd take a gun and just end it all right away. Because you're nothing but a dog. You're not a thing but a dog. If they want you to cut all night long out in the field, you cut. And if they want you to hang all night long, you hang. You hang tobacco. It didn't matter about your tired, being tired, you're afraid to say you're tired.
Tell us more about these tapes and how you got them and what's in them.
The tapes were part of a larger project, which is something that takes place mostly in the 1930s. This is going out and interviewing surviving ex-slaves. And most of these were done by the Works Progress Administration, part of the New Deal of Franklin Roosevelt. The New Deal was trying to put people to work, so they would take grad students whose programs had shut down, school teachers had been laid off, and things like that, send them out there to interview elderly Americans and get their life stories. But what it amounts to is about 2,200 or so life histories of who survived enslavement.
And what did you learn from it?
Well, historians have been using these for a little while, but I think they've tended to either say, well, we believe every single thing they say, or we believe almost nothing of what they say, because many of the interviewees will say things that are contradictory. Like they'll say, well, my owner was very nice, but then they'll describe horrible things that happened on the next property over. And I think what you have to do is really engage with them as the products of people who, A, are very thoughtful about how they're telling their story, often to interviewers who they don't necessarily trust. Many of the interviewers were white, and this was the 1930s South. You can see this in the difference between the interviewers that are white, the kinds of stories they elicit and the way those stories are structured, and the interviewers who are black, who tend to get a much more sort of straightforward catalog of horrors.
So, Ed Baptist, what do you want ordinary Americans to take away from this book, the case that you're making that the life that we live today, the economy that we live in today, is based on an economy that started on slavery and we wouldn't be here today without it?
Yeah. When the United States achieves independence, it's fairly irrelevant on the world scene, and certainly as a part of the global economy, it's pretty much small potatoes. By the time the Civil War starts in 1860, it's the second largest economy in the world, and it's the single biggest contributor to the success of the first economy in the world, which is Great Britain. Great Britain depends on its textile industry. And much of that growth, much of that transformation, much of that initial push, which we're still riding on today, you know, we've done other things since then, but I like to think of those years as those initial years of accumulation in the retirement portfolio, which are we know are so important if you want to build a big nest egg. So we know that much of that growth, much of that success comes from labor that was extracted from enslaved people and even financial wealth that was based on enslaved people's bodies, which were traded and commodified. And we know that that contribution was massively important. I think the first thing we need to do is to recognize that slavery isn't something that made a few people wealthy but not other people, or made a few people in the South wealthy but not people in the North, or something that doesn't continue to have effects, not just on race relations or something like that. It clearly does that too, but on wealth and on power today. Slavery continues to have an impact on America in the most basic economic sense as well.
Ed Baptist, author of The Half Has Never Been Told, Slavery and the Making of American Capitalism. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.